Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, we're going to start off with some live music, but before that, we have a competition for you at home. We've got a trip to Dublin to the sold-out concert of A Woman's Heart with the Artie Concert Orchestra with Eleanor McAvoy, Wallace Bird and Maura O'Connell. And we have an overnight stay at the four-star Ivy Garden Hotel. Well, as you all know, A Woman's Heart is one of the most successful Irish albums of all time, selling more than 750,000 copies here alone. And in February, for the first time, Eleanor McAvoy, Maura O'Connell and Wallace Bird are joining the Artie Concert Orchestra for A Woman's Heart Orchestrated. Two Dublin dates sold out really fast, and a third one was added for Wednesday, the 19th of February, at the National Concert Hall, as well as one at the National Opera House in Wexford on the 18th. Well, this morning, I've got a pair of tickets to the concert in the NCH on the 19th to give away, along with bed and breakfast for two in the Ivy Garden Hotel, and a copy of A Woman's Heart, the Platinum Collection, a special 2CD set out now. Well, to be in with a chance this morning of winning the prize, just answer this really difficult question. Mary something appeared on the original A Woman's Heart album. Was it Mary White, Mary Black or Mary Harney? Well, your name and address and answer now to 51551, and I'm going to read out the name of the winner before the end of today's show. Good morning to the Whileaways here in studio. You're not allowed to answer that question, by the way. Thank you so much for coming in. The Whileaways, of course, Noli, Nicola and Noreanne are here with me this morning, all the way from Galway. I'm going to chat to you later on, but first you're going to sing live for us. What are you going to sing?
Our Christmas single called All the Lights On.
Fantastic. Off you go.
They're hanging white lights everywhere. It must be Christmas. The big wheel is up in Air Square. It must be Christmas. And I really wish you were here. Must be Christmas. There's a different feel in the air. It must be Christmas. And that same old song is stuck in my head. Must be Christmas. And I'm thinking about something you said. It must be Christmas. And they're going out to paint the town red. It must be Christmas. I'd have a hot one in Ogden's instead. It must be Christmas.
It's been such a long time, I dream of you still. I think of you when I'm alone. You've a place in my heart now, and you always. Really just want to be home.
Ooh. It's getting late now, nearly everyone's gone. Ooh. And there's a busker still singing that song.
Someone left all the lights on. Someone left all the lights on. All the lights on. Must be Christmas. La-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
was so beautiful. Thank you so much. You're going to go off and come back later on. Go off and have a coffee or a tea or fry in the canteen and come back and we'll chat to you later on. Well, my next guest this morning, look, to lose anyone you love at any age is difficult, but to lose your mother when you're only six is a different kind of tragedy. Mary Elsa Bragg has spent her life searching for and grieving for her mother, who took her own life. In her new book, Sleeping Letters, Mary Elsa, the daughter of broadcaster and writer Melvyn Bragg, who is also an ordained priest and duty chaplain of Westminster Abbey in London, writes about how she finally has managed to reconcile herself with her mother. And Mary Elsa joins me now from London. Good morning, Mary Elsa Bragg.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Listen, tell me about the process of writing this beautiful book. It's a series of letters to your mother, who was called Mary Elizabeth. You write the book while on two silent retreats, I think.
Yes, I often go on silent retreats, but this year and a couple of years before, I wrote my first novel on silent retreat, but that was me taking it myself and going into the fells. But this time I went on to two sort of organised silent retreats and felt like it was time to really review what I felt about my mother's death, to have a look at what I'd seen so far, what I felt so far, and just to take a risk of diving in and facing reality and see how I came out the other side.
Tell us a little about your mother, Mary Elizabeth, you know, what you know about her.
She was, her father was from Provence and her mother was a Parisian, although her family kind of came through Russia, but she was just lovely. She was, you know, very much part of the Piaf Brel movement, you know, the 1968 riots in Paris. That was her culture. She was... she would have called herself a real atheist, but I would say probably she was agnostic. She thought about something spiritual, some kind of spirituality, but wouldn't have wanted to call it religious. She was very much an artisan. She was a painter and a writer, and she very much believed in the artisan culture, which is why my Cumbrian family just adored her, because that's a very creative culture. Just, I mean, we're just across the Irish Sea from you, so we are also all tales by the fire, sing-alongs, and give us a good story, and writing, because it's a wonderful thing to do, painting, because you're taking in the fells, and she fitted right into that.
And of course your Cumbrian family is because your father Melvyn Bragg, that's from where he's from, isn't it?
Yes, we're generations of Cumbrians there. He was brought up in Wigton, a very small market town. And, you know, we still go there. Well, I mean, I've got lots of cousins and very much part of that family.
Now, you were only six, I think, when your mother died. Do you mind telling us what happened to your mother and what you know about how she died?
Oh, well, it's very sad, really. And the story continues to unfold for me, because I think when anyone dies in any way, but certainly with a suicide, which my mother took her own life, the question of how can that happen resounds for a lifetime. And I don't think grief is really, or shock is even a linear thing to go through. I think it's cyclical, and I think it returns, and there's another layer to look at. And if you're lucky and you have found a safe place somehow, even if it's on your own in the fells, or whether it's in a tradition, doesn't matter, but, or and with people who love you, if you found a safe space to be able to go through it again, you can find a renewed sense of peace. And of course, if you don't, I think it... And certainly in parts of my life, I think I tried to shelve it. And I think it makes you, made me, and I've seen it make other people shut down. And you're not really fully loving. You're not really fully in contact with your heart, because you're too frightened to feel the love, because the loss can be overwhelming.
And she was depressed, wasn't she? I think her marriage to your dad had broken down. And I also read, Mary Elsa, that the antidepressants that had been prescribed, that they were actually taken off the market in 71 because of the high percentage of suicides.
Yeah, yeah. It's Yes, so she was grieving. She had a very difficult relationship with my father, and it was also the 1960s, which was very difficult for relationships, and they were both crossing cultural boundaries. Certainly my father, you know, the first person in his family to stay on and study after 14, and let alone go to university. So there was an awful lot happening around them. So it was a very difficult time. But then she was in Jungian analysis, which was also quite experimental, a new form of trying to understand what's happening in your own conscious. And then drugs really came onto the scene to help people get through. And although I, even now I can see that it can be very helpful for people to have help, because mental illness is something that we need, really do need to take more notice of and appreciate and help people through. We also need to be very careful medicating people who are not well, because they don't really have a proper voice often to be heard to say, this isn't helping me, or I'm feeling worse, or, and it's certainly not right to be experimenting with new drugs with any illness, let alone mental illness.
Can you tell us about the moment, because it's very touching, about when I think your dad took you, was it to the church in Kew, and told you your mother had died?
Yeah, yes, that was the same day. Well, I mean, that morning, you know, I used to go into her bed in the mornings, and she'd lock the door, probably kindly, so that I wouldn't be able to see. And neighbours, she'd left a note with the neighbour next door, also trying to look after me, bless her, because she must have been in such profound pain to still function like that. Must have been very hard for her. And I was taken over to my best friend's house, and her father, who's the most incredible man, David Blomfield, went and broke in and found her. And then my father came down, and I was taken to my godmother's house, who gave me a little kitten called Marmalade. And then he took me to the church in Kew, which is where I lived with my mother, and told me that I wouldn't see her again. It was an empty church, and he wept, and I was sort of bewildered. I remember a cleaner came in at the back, and I remember feeling worried that she was seeing my father cry, which is something that as a six-year-old, I'd never seen. I still go to that church sometimes, because I'm still really great friends with the Blomfields and people who've lived there. And it was a very, very hard time for everybody. Any death is something that happens to a community, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you are a remarkable little girl, because reading your book, I mean, I think your dad, he had a breakdown almost after your mum's death, and although you were so young, you really looked after him.
Well, I think we tried to look after each other, and my Cumbrian grandmother stepped in a lot. She became my second mother, really. Amazing, Ethel Bragg. Hats off to you. I think we looked after each other, but he did have a breakdown, and it was devastating for him. He felt unbelievably guilty. And I think it is important to notice, with anyone who deals with this kind of thing, that children often try and step in and look after people. Mm. And that's an important thing to notice, and try and help them to be a child. But it's always going to happen a little bit. And something... there was a bond that came out of the two of us kind of wading through a storm together. And I held on to his coattails too, and he used to take me to work with him, these old editing suites with tapes. I don't know if you remember them, but yeah. The sound of just rolling the tapes back and forward. And I'm afraid it was all men then, smoky rooms often, and working to the night with me with my colouring book in the corner, and just safe next to him. And also, I think though I didn't know it at the time, but now obviously as a woman I look back, I think making sure he was safe, I didn't want to lose him as well.
Writing this book, Marielsa, I mean, did it bring your mum back to you? I mean, people I know whose parents die when they're very young, sometimes they say they don't actually grieve for them until years later. What was it like in your case?
Yes, I think I've been through different stages of grieving for my mother in my life. And I think grief works like that. I don't think it's a linear kind of hero's journey and then it's over. I think you reintegrate. If you've lost somebody you've loved, even if it's someone you've found really difficult, but there's still an important relationship, that you come back to it again and again. The more you see life, the more you learn, you kind of start to reframe it again and you reintegrate it, and hopefully you keep the people you love with you and you keep loving them. So this book was at a point where, you know, I've been a priest for 15 years. I've had the honour to be very close to many families. I've seen a lot of life and I've seen really, really hard side of life, and I've seen the most extraordinary, beautiful, loving, stoic side of life. And there are, of course, times where I have incredible doubt, where I cannot understand how we could have to go through this. And there are times in life where I look at how extraordinary people are and think, goodness me, there's something magnificent about this. And this was a time where I felt like I wanted to give every ounce of what I'd found, every bit of heart and soul, to really face as much of the truth as I could and offer it up to both my parents with the prayer for healing.
Do you think, Marielsa, that it was your grief, I suppose, of the death of your mom and dealing with that, that was a catalyst in the way to your spiritual journey and now, of course, being an ordained priest in the Anglican Church?
Yeah, it could have been. I mean, it could have been, you know, we often get a wake-up call in life. Mm. It could have been that I woke up and very early said, what on earth is this all about? How can somebody so lovely end up like that? It just can't be right. What's going on? So I think that's been a really massive and quite important question. I'm not interested in a fantasy and a soothing faith that will sort of help me pretend that the world's okay. I want to find the truth. I want to find a love that's even bigger than that. And there's something about, you mentioned being with my dad in that church. Mm. I think a lot of people who even aren't religious find something that they don't understand in an empty church, because there's a presence. You can put the religion aside, but I think a lot of people are looking to be able to connect with something that it's okay to not understand, but something bigger, some kind of presence that you might get to know as you get older, as you live more life. It maybe isn't age-related, because you can have experiences at any age, but there's perhaps something more to all of this.
And although you're in the Anglican Church now, of course, you did spend many years, didn't you, searching for meaning and looking into other, like Buddhism, Judaism, different kinds of spirituality, before you actually ended up in the Anglican Church?
Yes, I did. It was wonderful. I met Tibetan, you know, lamas, and I went into Buddhist meetings and watched people chant, and Hindu and Jewish and Muslim, and I really was searching for what was out there. And then I hit a wall. I found these really beautiful, like the poetry of Rumi and Jewish mysticism, and I found these incredibly beautiful things, and I realized that I was finding them beautiful because I didn't have the challenge of the dark side of my own tradition in them. And I realized that I needed to try and find something really sacred in my own tradition. So I started to study. I went to university and I studied theology, and I realized that this incredible heritage of mysticism, ritual, poetry, art, literature, is so rich and so beautiful, and I couldn't see it really being passed on. And I realised that I just didn't want it to be lost. So I went in. I felt that that allowed me to breathe. I feel that ritual gives me space to doubt and love and question and feel held at the same time. And I felt like this incredible, creative Christian tradition that's been passed down from one generation to another is something to be honoured, renewed by every generation, but passed on.
As well as dealing with the grief of your mum, you became really ill in your early 20s, didn't you? I think after an infection, your liver, your kidneys broke down. And you were actually, I think, was it correct, bedridden for 8 years?
Yeah. Oh, that was a very difficult time, but I can't remember a lot of it because I wasn't all there for a lot of it. It was kind of, yes, in a sort of semi-conscious state. It was, I had been working with the Diana Fossey team. You probably remember that film, Gorillas in the Mist. And yeah. I got a fantastic job at Stirling University because I was good at choreographic notation. So I was working with Tamarins and Marmosets and trying to note their movement so that I might be able to learn about body language and movement. And then maybe, if I was lucky, go out onto the field in Rwanda. But I managed, something got into a cart, or somehow I caught something tropical, and we didn't really think about it like that. So we didn't go. I didn't go to the hospital for tropical diseases. Sadly, we didn't think about that, and I was ill for a long time. But apparently, it takes 7 years for your liver to completely rebuild. And around the seventh year, I started to really wake up, and it was really a question of rebuilding my muscles and being able to sort of try and walk again and think properly again and build a life. And I was incredibly lucky because I spent many days in waiting rooms with people who were not able to rebuild as well as I luckily was. And I have no idea why, but I'm very grateful that I was able to.
You're duty chaplain of Westminster Abbey. What's it like to have Westminster Abbey as your place of work?
Well, I have to live there for the week, and I maybe do 2 weeks a year. Yes. It's incredible. It's such an honour. I feel like I grow every time I go there. I have to kind of live up to the expectation of you do an hour, a prayer on the hour every hour over the loudspeaker. And if you're lucky, you get to ask everybody to stand for a moment in silence, and you can feel this sudden silence in the Abbey because there are, you know, thousands of people visit that place each day to see all the treasures, all the tombs and the Poet's Corner, and then suddenly there's silence, and you take the midday Eucharist and the small services in the Chapel of Edward the Confessor, which is hidden behind the high altar that has been there since 1066, a place of ancient pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. It's such an honour.
And of course, the Anglican Church, now it's much more progressive than other religions, but still, I was reading in your book, for your ordination, the only clothes that were available were for men. You were asked to cut your hair. You weren't allowed to sing the gospel. Women's voices don't have the necessary gravitas, apparently. I mean, are you trying to change things from within?
Well, I was, you know, I was part of this incredible movement of women and men for equality. It wasn't until, you know, a few years ago that women were allowed to be bishops. And now there's a big question about language, which is why someone said to me, have you written a feminist Eucharist in this book? And I think I would say, if it's a feminist Eucharist, it's because I'm a woman and I have written describing the Eucharist, which is unusual. Because I'm writing about my mother and because I'm writing as a woman, it's a lot of feminine imagery. But if anyone is in a movement like the extraordinary feminist movement that's been going on for generations, we all know that what we're really fighting for is equality between the masculine and the feminine and men and women. And so you can maybe see God or relate to God through the feminine or the masculine or both, and look for something that's encompassing but beyond all.
Now listen, you were the celebrant when your dad married again recently. What's it like marrying your father?
Well, I had the wedding speech and for the first time I had a good laugh because I said, well, I can certainly say I've just married my dad, and everyone roared and laughed. No, it was wonderful. It was in St. Bega's, and you'll know St. Bega very well because she came across from Ireland. She's a very important Cumbrian saint. She came across to St. Bee's first with this extraordinary bracelet that she was given by an angel because she didn't want to marry the Viking that her father wanted her to marry. He was going to put her in a barrel full of nails and have her roll down a hill, and luckily she escaped across the seas.
Good
and then
her.
came to an island in the middle of Bassenthwaite Lake, and that's where St. Bega's church is. It's been a place that I've been going to all my life. It's a very important place to me, and it's really interesting because I wrote about it in the book as a reconciliation scene for me and my mother and father. And it would have been natural for my father to marry in the Wigton church, where his parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts have all married. But he hadn't read the book, but he chose St. Bega's. So for me, not only did I marry him and his lovely new wife, Gabriel, in St. Bega's, but I also got to see him find a real chance of a new beginning at 80 years old, in a place that I had already, in a kind of deep, silent meditation, felt a sense of reconciliation and peace. It was very moving.
Which is wonderful. You're obviously religious. Do you believe you will meet your mother again? Do you believe in an afterlife?
I do believe in an afterlife. I have to say, in all honesty, that I believe in an afterlife because I've done so many funerals. I feel that I've experienced sort of seeing people, I can feel that you really do pass over, something of us passes over. But I don't think it's wise to be dogmatic about any belief, because we've only got a small human minds to begin to understand. But I do believe, no matter what we've done, in that moment of passing through, there's something bigger than everything that we've done that does welcome each one of us equally.
Writing the book, has it been a very positive experience for you? And finally, why did you write it?
I think it has been a positive experience for me because I really feel like I've as a woman now, poured out every ounce of love and soul and hope that I have into that book. And I really did face the difficult things. So it's not a fantasy book. It was a real journey for me. I find it a bit healing because my father has said that it's settling in him. He's rereading it and it's a book that you can dip into once you've read it once, and he says he's finding it healing, which is a remarkable gift. And and why I wrote it really was, it just felt time. Sometimes you just know it's time to say something, and it felt time to not just say something to my mother and my father, but say something to myself, to test and check something truthfully in myself, and to leap out, probably push a bit, and to really talk with God in my own way. And I hope it's a universal book. It's very, my tradition is very Christian, but going through a deep tragedy is universal, and finding something, anything, that's a really strong ritual and heritage that people have used before you, that you believe you can really hold on to help you through, is also universal.
Were you worried, Marielsa, when you decided to write it, that it would bring up everything, all the pain of the past, and that your father would be very upset about you writing it or not?
I checked it with him, actually, whether I would let him read it or let anyone read it. It wasn't necessarily written to be published. My father has ever been in pain. It's not something you could bring up. It's always there. Part of the impulse of this book is a plea that anything can be faced. I have to believe, no matter what we've done, if we face it with love, we can find a new path. We can't condone. If we condone, and I don't think we really get through, but anyone who's been involved in any truth and reconciliation movement, they know that the real humanity with any mistake we've made or any difficult situation we face, if that true humanity is found, we can get through.
Well, it's a beautiful tribute to both your father and your mother. And if I can say so, you have a beautiful speaking voice, a broadcasting voice like your father.
Thank you.
And your book is called Sleeping Letters by Mary Elsa Bragg. It's published by Chatto and Windus. It's available now. Thanks so much for chatting to us this morning. It's a lovely
thank
book.
Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Well, my next guest is another writer, but Joseph O'Connor is one of our finest writers. Recently, he just won the Irish Book of the Year at the Irish Book Awards for his novel Shadow Play, and now it's been nominated in the hotly contested Costain Novel of the Year. And Joseph is sitting opposite me now. Good morning.
Hi, Miriam. How
are you? Listen, you're also working on the screenplay for a Hollywood producer, which sounds very exciting.
It is exciting, I must say. I love screenwriting, and it's a kind of writing that is, it's very creative, but it comes with a whole set of rules around, you know, the length of the script. It must be in three acts. Things must happen on certain pages. So it's kind of a blend of creativity and sort of engineering, I suppose, or architecture. So it's a lovely thing to be doing, and I'm excited about it, and I hope it works out for Shadow Play.
Yeah, tell people about Shadow Play, what it's about.
Oh, well, it's a love story, I suppose. It's loosely based on the real life friendship between our own Bram Stoker from the north side of Dublin, the man who wrote Dracula. Most of his adult life, Stoker spent in London. He was a theatre manager. He worked at the Lyceum Theatre, which is very much still there on the Strand in London. And his two great friends there were Henry Irving, who is considered the greatest Shakespearean actor of his day. And some actors still really revere him as the greatest actor of all time. And then Ellen Terry, who I suppose is the first theatrical superstar. And there's a period of sort of 6 or 7 years when these three remarkable artists are working and almost living really in the same place. So it's a fiction, you know, it's researched, but I mean it is made up, and it's about the very ardent, very intense love between these three people.
You also always loved Bram Stoker, didn't you? Where did you get your interest or love for him?
I've been asked a lot about it this year, and I suppose Bram has been part of my life for so long that I've kind of in some ways forgotten how he came to me first. But I think it's true to say it's through my grandmother, my late maternal grandmother. She was a great storyteller, and she used to tell a story, a bit of a tall story, I think, about how a relative of hers had met Bram Stoker back in Victoria in Dublin. And he always just intrigued me, I suppose, in a sense, Miriam, because we talk about him so little. I mean, there's a, you know, there are bridges and things named after Yeats and Beckett and Joyce. But Stoker always seemed to be a little bit forgotten about. So he intrigued me for that reason.
And that grandmother you spoke about, she used to tell you ghost stories, didn't she?
Yeah, she was a great storyteller. And she loved the kind of ghost stories of Dublin in particular. She had stories about the Hellfire Club up in the mountains. And if you walked around, I think it was the Pepper Canister Church, if you walked around it three times, the devil would appear. and Marsh's Library in town was a great source of one of her stories. Marsh's Library was founded by a man burdened with the terrible name of Archbishop Narcissus Marsh. And there was a young woman in his life, a niece, I think, a ward, who ran away with her lover and couldn't bear to tell him face to face. So the story was that she had left a letter explaining her decision in one of the sort of 5,000 books in Marsh's library. And so every night the ghost of Narcissus would appear and tear through the books looking for the letter. So she was a great storyteller, yeah.
And your great dad, Sean, he had a big influence on you as well, in terms of even as a writer.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Sean is he's a lovely man, and I feel very privileged and honoured to have him as my dad. I don't think actually that I would have been a writer without him. Well, maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but he was certainly always kind of very supportive and very validating about it. He loved reading himself. He was brought up in Francis Street in the Dublin Liberties and went to Francis Street Christian Brothers School, of which he's rightly very proud. And there was a brother there who taught the lads the big kind of well-sprung Victorian epic poetry of people like Tennyson. And my dad used to read me that as a kid. And I think it was secretly his way of teaching me to read. But it was brilliant storytelling. And I just remember it very fondly and intimately as a particular way of being close with him. And, you know, I'm very grateful to have had that. There was one poem in particular that he loved. It was from The Mort d'Arthur by Tennyson, The Death of King Arthur.
Okay.
Famous legend. So it goes on. I mean, it's a long, long poem. But I might just read a stanza of it. It's King Arthur has, the battle has taken place that day and he's fatally wounded. And he says to his last knight, Sir Bedivere, to go down to the lake and to throw the sword Excalibur into the lake. And this is what Tennyson says. Then quickly rose Sir Bedivere and ran, and leaping down the ridges lightly, plunged among the bulrush beds and clutched the sword and strongly wheeled and threw it. The great brand made lightnings in the splendour of the moon and flashing round and round and whirled in an arch, shot like a streamer of the northern morn, seen where the moving isles of winter shock by night with noises of the northern sea. So flashed and fell the brand Excalibur, but ere he dipped the surface rose an arm, clothed in white samite, mystic, wonderful, and caught him by the hilt and brandished him three times and drew him under in the mirror and lightly went the other to the king. So it was just the colour and the drama and the exuberance of it just really appealed to me as a child. And funny, I mean, in my own writing still, I see something often that tries to be that. It certainly aspires to be that. I love when prose is kind of performance and when it's full of colour and music. And I think I got that from my dad.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to meet him years ago with you, actually. Like, he's Superman.
He's like
you great. Now teach creative writing, don't you?
Yeah.
Can you teach someone to be a good writer? I mean, you're naturally, obviously, a good writer, but can you actually teach someone to be a good writer?
I always say to the students at the University of Limerick, where I teach, I'm the professor of creative writing there, we can't teach you to be talented and we can't teach you to have a work ethic. And the work ethic is the most important thing for a writer. You need to be able to just be very persistent, very dogged and very grown up if you want to be serious about writing. But if you have either of those two things, there are things that you can learn. There are ways in which we can help. We wouldn't say to a kid who is a talented violinist or a talented dancer that they shouldn't go and study their craft. So it's odd that we sometimes do say that to writers. So the most important things can't be taught. We hope at UL Creative Writing that we are able to help people to polish and to treasure and respect the gift that they have and to bring it forward, yeah.
Because I'm conscious there's probably people listening this morning who'd love to be a writer and have maybe dreamt about being a writer but have not actually either successfully managed to finish a novel or even to get it published.
Yeah.
Did you always know you would make it? Was there ever a moment when you were trying to be a writer?
I don't know that I knew. I mean, I think a certain kind of grain of stupidity almost is quite important for a writer to have. I mean, I remember being young and in university and people saying, but sure, you can't be a writer. Nobody can be that. Like, that's something that Keats used to do. That's not something that actually works in the modern world. And I think you need the ability to kind of just put your fingers in your ears and not listen to people and just be, as I say, very dogged and determined. Certainly, it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I mean, I've wanted to be a a writer since I was 14 or 15, and I feel I'm very privileged and honoured that it's worked out that way. And I don't, there wasn't a plan B. I don't know what I would have done if it hadn't worked out. So I think, you know, you do need to be quite ardent about it. It's a kind of love that it's more like marriage actually than falling in love, I think. You know, you need to be committed to writing for better or worse, and for richer or poorer, and you hope that it will work out over the long term. And there are days when you in writing mightn't be getting on particularly well at all. You might have a little row with writing, and writing might tell you to feck off, and you might say to writing that you're sorry you ever met. So you have little sort of fallings in and fallings out, but you hope, as I say, that over the continuum of a life that it will be worthwhile.
That's
but
a really nice way of putting
it.
Yeah. I also read, you spoke about, you know, the quote from Dennis Potter, where he said that every author should look back on their early works with contempt. Is that a bit harsh? You know, like
he said with affectionate contempt.
Well, okay, fine.
Is what he said. So, yeah, I mean, it's I certainly have an affection for one or two of my early books. And contempt is a little bit much, I must say. I mean, I can see their flaws, I can see their faults, but I can also see in them, you know, a young writer trying to find a voice. And maybe because I do teach now, I kind of, I can respect that. I can see how powerful it is for somebody who's new to writing, just being consumed by that desire to make their own contribution. So of course they trip themselves up, and of course I tripped myself up in my early books, and I much prefer shadow play to the first one or two books that I wrote. But yeah, they have a place in my heart, of course, yeah.
And awards, like at the beginning when I introduced you, I mean, you just won, you know, Book of the Year at the Book Awards, and the Costa Novel, it's an amazing award to be nominated for.
It is, yeah.
Do they matter?
Oh, Miriam, I'd love to say that they don't. And I mean, in the pure part of my heart, you know, of course they don't.
Yeah.
And John Banville said about a month ago, the thing about literary prizes is that they appeal to the child in you. And I just said to you, a writer needs to be grown up. You need to be very, very single-minded and just do the work. Just do the work as best you can. But then a prize comes along, or a nomination comes along, and the child in you says, oh, wouldn't that just be lovely? Wouldn't it be great to have that? And, you know, the Irish Novel of the Year Award, it was a lovely night. I was there with Anne-Marie. Everybody claps you on the back and gives you a hug. And it's a lovely moment of affirmation. You'd be silly to kind of fall for it. I mean, that's all it is. It's a beautiful sort of illusion. But you know, as illusions go, it's a nice one to have.
No.
But you go back to work then the next day, and you just you write as well as you can.
I suppose it's extra nice, though, because it is almost lonely being a writer. I mean, you work alone, isn't that it? So
you do, yeah. I mean, it's an odd way for a grown up to spend their time. I mean, I spend a lot of time in a room by myself making things up, and you know, it's. I suppose it's one reason why it's nice to have the job at UL. You know, it's nice to have colleagues. I work with the great writer Donal Ryan, you know, the young adult author Sarah Moore Fitzgerald, who was herself nominated on the night of the awards, is a colleague. So I see them often. And it's nice to have that. You know, sometimes, you know, when you're writing, you spend so much time by yourself. I don't know, you forget how to talk to people. You know, there's a particular stage of great intensity near the end of, you know, finishing a book. It's like doing the Leaving Cert, you know, all over again. And you're just so single-minded, and you forget to wash yourself. And you, as I say, you kind of forget how to deal with the world. So it's why I've always done other things. You know, I've written for the radio, as you know, and the teaching, and I find I kind of need that. I wouldn't like to be a full-time, 100% all the time writer. I think it's good for a writer to be out in the world and to kind of see what's going on, you know?
I love live radio. Frank just texted in to say, Miriam, say to Joe that Bram Stoker's brother, you know this probably already, Joe, was a surgeon who treated Michael David for complications arising out of a dental procedure But he died of blood poisoning in 1906.
Yeah, Thornley, I think, was Bram Stoker's brother. Yeah. Well, Michael Davitt is my favourite person in Irish history, 19th century Irish.
Is he?
Yeah, I think he was really remarkable. Man, he had such a difficult childhood, brought up in Lancashire, as you know, and had an accident in the factory where he worked, lost his arm, was sent to school by the owner of the factory, and kind of defeated the British Empire without ever firing a shot. And he was a really remarkable man.
Now, but just before I let you go, are you on to your next book already, or are you focusing on the script? Writing for Shadowplay.
Yeah, I'm working on the script of Shadowplay, and that's a lot of fun. But I have the next one in mind. I'm going to write a novel, I hope, about another great person from Irish history, Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, who worked in the Vatican during the Second World War and who saved many people from the Nazis. So I'm gently hoping to get down to researching that and to writing that soon, as soon as the script for Shadowplay is done. He's just another really intriguing,
fascinating
character, and he won't let me go, you know. So so I have to write a novel about him next.
Well, as ever, Joseph O'Connor, congrats on all your awards. Best of luck with the nomination for the Costa Novel of the Year. Keep being great, and thanks so much for being my guest.
It's a pleasure
this
to be with you, Miriam. Thanks very much.
Well, I've been rejoined here by the Whileaways, who sang so beautifully earlier. Just to say, lots of people asking who was that writer earlier on. She was Mary Elsa Bragg, and the name of her book was Sleeping Letters. That's her new book. Welcome back. You're going to sing for us again,
which is
fantastic. Noli, Nicola and Noriana. You have a big concert coming up on Friday, haven't you?
We do. It's kind of our end of year home concert in the Black Box Theatre in Galway. So it's next Friday, the 20th of December, to kind of wrap up the year for us. So looking forward to that. There's still a few tickets left from the Town Hall Theatre Galway. THD.ie.
And you've had a great year, haven't you?
We have, yeah. This year's been really interesting for us. We had a great trip to America. Galway 2020 sent us out there in great company with some other Galway musicians to the Milwaukee Irish Festival. And we were in Butte, Montana and Chicago as well. And then we were also involved in a really lovely project called Bird on the Wire with some other musicians, where presented the songs of Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
And that's going to go into the springtime for us as well. It's going to take us to England and to the Olympia Theatre as well.
Brilliant. Yeah. That's beautiful. I heard you do that before. Listen, what are you going to sing us out on today?
We're going to sing a brand new song that we've never done before. We said, here's the spot to do it.
Yeah. What's it called?
It's a brand new song about a very old story. It's called Toss the Bobbin. And we were asked by a group from where we live called the Headford Lace Project to try and put into song the forgotten history of the women of the area who were lace makers.
Great. Looking forward to it. Just before you start, the winner of our competition today, congratulations Frieda Casey from Drumahair in County Leitrim. Well done. You're heading off to a Women's Heart concert with our orchestra. My thanks and sound today to Sheila Neve-Weal. Denise Davies was our BCO. Shannon Gorman produced. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until, take it away, the Whileaways.
The sun rose in the morning, went down at its own pace, and the women of Headford made lace. My name, and I work these hands with pride. From across the lake, now my family's by my side, and I make my living here. A few pennies at a time. Mary is my name, they call me widow since he died. Every day's the same, I lay flowers by his side, and in the evening I make lace for a few pennies at a time. Toss the bobbin and around the pin, these hands will work to feed our kin, toss the bobbin and around the pin, steady moving as I sing. Margaret is my name, and I work these hands with pace. The merchants come around, they hardly pay me for my lace. Still I work so carefully. For a few pennies at a time. And I'll sing, toss the bobbin and around the pin. These hands will work to feed our kin. Toss the bobbin and around the pin, steady moving as I sing. Catherine is my name, the girls all call me Kate. I meet them every day with our bobbins and our lace, and we keep each other strong. And we know that we'll be fine, because there's laughter and there's songs. And a few pennies at a time. Toss the bobbin and around the pin. These hands will work to feed our kin. Toss the bobbin and around the pin, steady moving as I sing.